Hi, I'm Tara, and welcome to Sagas and Sass Season 4, brought to you by Geek Saga Entertainment. This is Episode 70, and we are continuing our discussion of Dark Age, the fifth installment in Pierce Brown's Red Rising saga.
I'm fellow Sagas and Sass host Nick, and this episode covers Darrow's POV chapters from Craft and Treason, Parts 2 and 3 of Dark Age.
And I'm regular guest host Seth, here to remind you that the Sagas and Sass Red Rising coverage is spoiler-free outside of the chapters we cover in each episode. However, just a warning that this Darrow discussion will feature some spoilers for our next episode, as some of Darrow's chapters overlap with Lysander's.
That said, don't forget that the opinions are those of us as individuals and don't necessarily reflect the opinions of the show as a whole, but let's be real. Usually we're all on the same page, or at least very close to it.
Last but not least, don't forget to check out our Patreon. With 10 tiers ranging from $1 a month to $40 a month, it offers tons of ways to support us and receive some great perks in return, including access to the video recordings of these episodes within 24 hours of us recording them, usually less, and early access to our podcast episodes. You can find us at patreon.com/geeksaga_entertainment.
We pick back up in the wake of Orion's storms. Darrow hosts a mass funeral for the 100,000 bodies of the 4 freaking million who died. I mean, hey, at least he admits that the Battle of Ladon wasn't actually a victory for the Republic. Meanwhile, it sounds like Atalantia lost twice as many people as the Republic did, but she also has the ability to pull raw recruits from elsewhere, so it seems like despite this supposed victory, they're kind of, you know, fucked. Oh, and Calloway has been away trying to find Orion's body, which he does, but Darrow realizes that when Calloway counts his kills, he's not counting up, but down. How many can he kill before he goes? So listen, it's really not good. None of this is good, especially when they have to collapse the tunnels that Alexander would have used to return to him. He might have saved over 80,000 people, but they have to relegate themselves to the fact that he's most likely dead. Bad shit all around. Things are fucked, and there's no way around it. They don't have the ships they need to escape, and a good portion of the local populace is against them. Sure, as far as they know, Mustang is still fighting to send them reinforcements, but Darrow gets a call from Atalantia herself that sadly disabuses them of this notion.
Okay, it doesn't start off all that bad, the call, I mean, because she hilariously tries to school him about the history of Pyrrhus, which Darrow already knows because, hey, he didn't waste their tax dollars on a bad education. He even gets in some digs about how the Ash Lord, aka Atalantia's father, didn't really like her before she claps her hands and plays a recording of the Day of the Red Doves. Virginia is not coming, she tells him. Severo is not coming. No one is coming. And yet, even as Darrow considers mourning for his wife, it seems he doesn't really believe she's dead. And he also knows that if he doesn't leave Heliopolis and Atalantia tries to nuke it, she, Atalantia, will be deposed. So she needs him to surrender, but, lol, this is Darrow. Bad bet, Atalantia. Granted, he does take her 24-hour offer to his officers, but before they can answer, Screwface wakes him at the break of dawn to show him something, which turns out to be his remaining Martian sick with radiation getting baptized in the ocean. Listen, Darrow does not like this, and he kind of goes off on Screwface about it, which, rude, dude was just trying to help, and hey, in the midst of this, something like 36 obelisks bust through the shields and land in the ocean. Darrow and Screw race out to open one, having some fun in the process, which, let's be honest, good for them. And it turns out the obelisks are filled with supplies. Food, anti-radiation meds, and above all, a message of hope from Mustang. Atalantia attempts to retaliate, but the shields are back up before she can, and by the time Darrow returns to home base, Harnassus and the others have decided that they trust Darrow to deliver them from Mercury. So at this point, Darrow summons Glorastes to apparently make a giant EMP, because, lol, of course, it's always an EMP, y'all. Problem is, Glorastes won't finish his work without sardines, because he requires sardines for breakfast every Tuesday, and he's fresh out. I mean, first of all, gross. Second of all, at this point, the only place they can possibly get sardines is from Severo's quarters, which are booby-trapped to the extreme. seriously, no one wants to try to enter Sevro's quarters. So it's Darrow who has to take the hit. And it's a literal hit, at least until Sevro's booby traps determine that it's Darrow who's trying to enter, at which point he presumably gets enough clearance to fetch the sardines, considering Glorastes does in fact continue working.
Next thing we know, though, Alexander is back, along with a supposed pixie named Cato and Atlas Elra, a.k.a. the Fear Knight, as prisoner. Which all seems a bit odd, but hey, this rando Cato passes all the tests, so clearly there's nothing to see here and everything is totally fine, right? Right? Really, the most important thing is that despite the condition Alexander arrives in, the medics are able to fix him up, and despite everything that he went through, he remains the perfect cinnamon roll he always was. Snaps for Alexander. Problem is, Cato's arrival throws a new wrench into the whole Glorastes situation, because apparently the two of them go way back, and the Master Maker is not happy that they're keeping his old friend locked up. So this time he demands that Cato be sent to his home, or, you guessed it, he'll stop working for Darrow. Of course, Darrow gives in, but Screwface puts a monitor spike in Cato before sending him off with Glorastes, so they assume they'll at least be able to find out if the Master Maker is their Master Maker, and considering whatever he's doing for them is probably the key to them getting out from under Atlantia's thumb, let's just say we're all hoping Glorastes is in fact still on their side.
This is a very frustrating and depressing discussion that we're about to have.
This whole book is a frustrating and depressing. Yes. Like, I was reading through that and I'm like, oh yeah, no, that's the thing that, you know, the thing that's definitely not the Red Wedding. And yeah, there's a lot that happens in this book that I take issue with, but you've already covered a bunch of it, so I won't get into it.
Honestly, to me, for this part, starting with it being so sad when Calloway's HR returns with Orion's body after refusing to rest until he found her because she was his mentor. And the situation is just so sad because this is Orion and how she went was awful. And Calloway is rightfully a mess about it. And he's been keeping track of his kills. And Darrow suddenly realizes that the number isn't actually counting up. As we said, it's counting down to the number of kills Calloway can make before he goes.
Darrow looks back on Orion's body one last time, thinking it's a horrible thing to see someone so full of life, so important in yours and those of others, humbled by death. There's no comfort to know this thing is no longer her, just the rotting shell of what held a miracle of a soul. Does she go to Io and Ragnar and Fichtner, or is she simply gone? I do not know. Nor do I know how I will go on without her. I feel cold despite the sun, desperate to feel the warmth of my family, my wife, my son. Knowing how short our time in the light is, am I the greatest of fools to not spend every moment by their side?
I mean, kinda, yeah.
Here's my problem with... Sorry, I said I wasn't going to do this, and now I'm going to do this.
As long as you're going backward and not forward.
Oh, fine. Yes. The only thing I will go forward on is something I'm already on record on, is that we find out later that Mustang's a size queen. Anyway, the reason I keep mentioning it is because it's really kind of pointless, but okay. So Piers really seems to be trying to make a point about what constant war for that long can do to a person, even a peerless scarred, even an iron gold, even if, you know, you're Darrow who was retrofitted as one of those. Except every time he writes the bad guys, it's clear that Darrow had to do this because they were an existential threat to the Republic. Mm-hmm. Every time. It's like, yes, it would have been great if he'd had more time to spend with his family. That would have been fantastic. But also, I don't know, there's a lot of ways in which it feels like Piers is trying to have his cake and eat it too. And mostly I just want our heroes to get a little break. I sometimes feel like this about heroes in sequel series where I'm just like, they made their goddamn bones, give them a break.
Yeah. No, I completely agree with that. I feel like for the hero POVs, we just keep having things lumped onto them. Like every time they seem to get some kind of break, there's almost immediately a counterbalance of more shit. And it's so difficult to go through that constantly. And I take your point about the wages of war, so to speak, on anybody, but it does really also feel like they never catch a break.
Yeah.
And if they do, there's a corresponding bad break that has to happen immediately afterwards that undoes whatever success they've had.
Yeah, I think my biggest problem with this is honestly the Day of the Red Doves. I mean, and it's supposed to be this big shocking scene, and it's a big shocking scene, and that's great, and it's fine, and it's big and shocking, and it's like, okay, but based on some other things that happened earlier, you're sure they had absolutely no hint of this 10-year-long, intricate, so fragile that if somebody stumbles across the wrong thing, the whole plan is going to collapse? Plan? There was no hint anywhere. I'm all right now. It's okay.
At least Darrow doesn't totally believe that Mustang is dead. But I think some of that might be because so many other people are dead. So before we get into the Mustang conversation, Darrow has to face Alexander's possible, probable, at least at the time he thinks, death.
Yeah, because they've been waiting for Alexander to return from his rescue attempts in Tyche, but it's past time to collapse the tunnel, and the risk of keeping them open just continues to grow, and he should have reached them by now.
And Rana, Darrow's niece, has been waiting for Alexander more than anyone, and even she understands it's past time to close these tunnels because, you know, as you said, they leave them open to attack. Darrow asks the centurion he brought with him what the final refugee count is, that being the number of people that Alexander and his people saved, and it was 83,426 souls.
Darrow turns to Rona and says, 83,426 souls. Not many are lucky enough to know how much their life is worth.
Still. Anyway, back to the Mustang conversation.
Yeah, I mean, this is just, even for something that's called the Dark Ages, this is a slog. This whole book is just like, he's like, I notice you guys all like George Tuars. He punches you in the face a lot, right? You like it punched in the face when you read a book? You like that? Do you?
You want another punch?
Yeah, you want another, maybe another one? Huh?
Every other chapter, pretty much.
Yeah.
But speaking of punches.
Yeah.
Eventually, Atalantia cold calls Darrow to talk some shit. She tries to give him a history lesson, but he just tells her she is lacking. The least loved daughter of a butcher who probably convinced herself this was simply because she was misunderstood. But he insists, you are not misunderstood by your father, Atalantia. You were simply disliked. Aja was his pride. Moira was his joy. You were just there. With your silk and your Venusian orgies acting out to get attention, and now you're his last resort. The pitiable last sentence of a family saga that is almost over. Even if you beat us here, the world has changed, and there's no place for you in it.
Unfortunately, Atalantia has that news for him regarding the Day of the Red Doves, including a recording which shows Daxo's horrible death, Rip Daxo, and Mustang.
Literally.
Yeah. Beaten and bloody, looking as if she's dying. Although, as we mentioned, Darrow refuses to believe she is gone. And Atalantia taunts him, all these years you must have felt so trapped, knowing what needed to be done, but unable to do it because of people weaker than you. If you had just marched your legions into the Senate instead of chasing after my father, you could have won this. Once you had the power, you could have remade the world with your wife at your side, however you saw fit, and put your son on the throne. But that is the noble lie of democracy, isn't it? The belief in humanity, even though humanity is a screaming, selfish mob. I needed to see your face as you realized we were right all along.
She threatens nukes, but Darrow knows that if she nukes Mercury, she will be deposed. And he knows that she needs to leave because the Republic is in turmoil and she could finish it. But she also needs them to surrender because she's afraid of it.
Not that she'll ever admit that. Atalantia is something else. And we see a lot more of her later in the book. But for now, she's a piece of work. We do know that, at least, with her poison and her snakes and her painting out of her family's faces in the mural whenever one of them dies. This is what Darrow's up against. Oof. We do get a little bit of a bright spot when Screwface comes to visit later and tells Darrow he needs to show him something.
Darrow wants Screwface to just tell him there, but his friend insists, oh, come on, who do you trust if you don't trust old Screw?
And Darrow remembers he has been with me since the beginning, never asking for anything, never earning fame like Severo or family like Pebble and Clown. He is maybe the most like me, a creature of war. It looks lighter on him.
Darrow follows Screw out to the water where his army, or at least the members from Mars, are sick from radiation and are essentially being baptized, for lack of a better word. I don't know, it's weird.
Darrow isn't too happy about this, but he moves on down the beach and is eventually rewarded as a bunch of obelisks land in the water not far from shore. Obelisks that end up containing not just the supplies and anti-rads that they so desperately need, but also a delayed message from Mustang.
Which, of course, he's already said he doesn't really want to, or maybe he's not able to believe that Mustang is dead. But this is a very delayed message. Still, probably the most important thing she says is, "You know, I believe we all begin equal parts light and dark. I fear you think your strength lies in your darkness. But the measure of man is not the fear he sows in his enemies. It is the hope he gives his friends. I only ask that you remember what you mean to me, to your people, to your son. You have not been abandoned. I will come for you. Severo will come for you. The Republic will come for you. Until then, endure, my love. Endure."
Really glad there's a comma between endure and my love.
Yeah.
Endure, my love.
Endure, my love. It's really, like, obviously, like, I can't tell. That is somehow both an uplift and a punch at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
It's like, hey, this is great, but you got some news, my friend. I also just, I want to say this because it is something the other side doesn't seem to have learned in however long this has been going on now, for like 13 years, I think, total, including the first three books. How did this all start? It started with a martyrdom.
Mm-hmm.
And if you think killing Darrow is going to make things better in the long run, I have a bridge to sell you.
Yeah, you'd be dumb.
Yeah, this is just like, yes, we've gotten rid of Darrow and Mustang and everybody's fine. Why do they keep rebelling every 25 to 50 years? Yeah, that's...
Yep.
Anyway,
apparently there's some EMP work going on because, of course, it's an EMP. It's fucking always an EMP.
A master maker, Glorastes, is helping them despite how angry he is about the misuse of the storm gods. Let's be real, rightfully so. And one of the things he's demanding in return for his continued work is sardines, which no one has. But hey, there are probably some in Severo's stateroom because that's why he always smelled like fish.
Honestly, just the idea that somebody has to eat sardines every Tuesday is... ugh. But as we mentioned in the summary, no one wants to go into Severo's stateroom. They all know it's booby-trapped. And Darrow's like, "You're a bunch of superstitious idiots. Fine, I'll go myself." Only, yeah, the stateroom is absolutely booby-trapped. And he gets shot full of needles when he tries to enter, followed by a hologram of Severo repeating, "Don't touch my shit," over and over again. Some levity yeah. In these chapters.
I just think of that virus scene from Jurassic Park where the like the computer virus hits and it's just the guy.
Oh yeah.
That's what the image is in my head. But
I had a similar thought, but it was the viruses from Hackers instead of Jurassic Park.
Dennis, sorry. You didn't say the magic word. If this ever gets made into some sort of show or movie series or whatever, I really want to see like a Jurassic Park take on that. Don't touch my shit. Don't touch my shit.
Yeah. All right. Now, when Darrow recovers from the first onslaught, he turns off the hologram, but is pricked by another needle that apparently samples his DNA and just lol. Because as soon as this happens, a sexy voice says, and I hope you're all ready for this. "Badass class DNA detected. Profile match for Darrow of Lycos, best friend, also known as Reaper, boss, Howler One, Apex asshole, brother, Mustang's bitch. Second class clearance granted. Welcome. I apologize for warning shots. Master has been notified of your skulking. Sticky finger traps deactivated. Help yourself to a glass of scotch, best friend. Take in some music, Reaper. Admire the trophies from the decimated enemies of the noble Howlers, boss. Enjoy the extensive pornography library, Howler One. Relax in the sauna, Apex asshole. It has no traps. But above all else, steal nothing and enjoy your stay in Severo's palace. I assume that there is unicorn porn, right? The unicorn porn is...
I'm sure, yeah.
We just want to check on that. All right. Darrow does question why he's second class, but the hologram simply replies, yes, Master says you know why.
We never find out why, damn it. I want to know.
I mean, maybe we'll find out why in the next couple of books when Piers needs to lighten the mood.
Yes, we'll get another one of these scenes.
Steal nothing. If there were sardines in there, which we have to presume there were, Darrow does take them. Maybe sardines are fine. He's saying steal nothing about all the other stuff.
Yeah.
Because seriously, Severo's rooms are something else. Darrow quickly realizes that if a man's soul can be seen in the room, he keeps the cleanest. Severo's soul is his armory. One wall has suits of armor and a shrine of knives, replacement razors, pulse fists, and more. Another wall is just a wall of memories, one of Ragnar's razors, Weed's old pipe, Quinn's howler cloak, the bloody cape Octavia wore the day they killed her, and in a place of honor, the sling blade that Darrow used at the Institute. The last wall is for his family, hollows of his girls, little bracelets and tokens, ink footprints and palm paintings, a cape Victor gave him when they sailed for Earth, a golden unicorn figurine, and his father's Ares helmet. And the bench where Severo would dress for battle faces that wall. Listen, I'm not crying. You're crying.
Oh, just the thought of Severo, especially Severo, because he is so snarky and just kind of goblin nasty, particularly in fights. Obviously, we know he's super in love with Victra and just obsessed with his daughters, like such a great dad. But the thought of him dressing for battle, staring at all of the little trinkets from his family, is especially knowing that we don't know where he is right now, is sad. Like really fucking sad. Okay. So that was a moment of levity that ended not so funny, unfortunately. But remember when we talked about everyone assuming Alexander was dead and how much his life was worth and how sad all of that was?
Well, he does, in fact, show back up, badly injured, but he is there to return Darrow's wolf cloak and brought an additional gift, the Fear Knight, bound and trussed. As soon as Alexander is with the medics, of course, Darrow goes to have a little chat with Atlas. He's about to cut off Atlas's ears because of fucking course, Atlas cut off Alex's ears, so makes sense to return the favor. But he realizes he would be doing so for himself and it wouldn't do his army any good.
Points for Darrow, I guess, especially when he still stays his hand despite Atlas saying, all of a man's affairs become diseased when he wishes to cure evils by evils. For order, I impaled soldiers. For liberty, you drowned cities. The victor writes history with the blood of the vanquished. I wonder, in the end, which of us will turn out the hero. Don't you?
A P.S. Atlas isn't the only person Alex brought back with him. And yes, yes, of course, we all know who the other person is. Lysander, little bitch. I got a little cough there.
Got a little something stuck in my throat.
Have no idea. They test him and only note that he has an abnormally powerful heartbeat and has clearly trained his body against being poisoned. Yes, that's what Mithraism is. Everything else checks out, and they even kind of brush off the fact that Lysander's limbic system has some unusual synaptic activity, which is possibly a sign of childhood trauma and memory suppression, which we've gotten tastes of earlier in the book. So when Glastes demands that his old friend be released to his care if they want him to continue working for them, they do. But like, Darrow straight up wonders how such a supposedly unremarkable pixie survived their escape when soldiers like Crastus and Drusilla didn't. And like, OMG, dude, maybe follow through with musings like that, you know?
Do they explain where the term Mithridatism comes from in the book? I forget.
They don't explain it in detail. It's basically like, it shows sign of Mithridatism.
Because Mithridates, a king of, oh gosh, I forget where, somewhere in the Middle East, who was in one of those types of royal families where it's like, you get to be the king by surviving the assassination attempts, took small amounts of poison, supposedly, to make himself immune to poison. So that's where it comes from. He did lose a fight that he ended up picking with Rome, which Honestly, I don't know why anybody at that point would have picked a fight with Rome, but, you know, Mithridates going to Mithridate.
Well, and I also think it's interesting that this is still showing up with Lysander when you have to assume that it happened when he was a child and not for the past 10 years while he was with Cassius. That's not something that we ever got any
Cassius sort of wasn't doing that.
Maybe the poisons are so powerful.
They have a long half-life.
Yeah. The gold genes are just hanging on to that. They're just hanging on to that. Oh, we should be immune to this.
I did hear you say point of order at one point. What was that for?
Oh, it's just point of order. You drowned cities. Point of order, Darrow did not. Darrow, in fact, expressly told Orion 80 times, don't drown the cities. I really feel that Orion got done dirty in this book. It's like, I need something really horrible to happen. All right. Well, Orion. Okay, sure. Fine. Why not?
In some ways, it feels like because we have Lysander as a POV character who we'll be addressing more of in the next episode, it felt like they needed something to justify some of Lysander's beliefs to continue his campaign against Darrow. And so then it was like, okay, how do we do that? Well, what if we have Orion do this?
And her decision, it comes back again and again and again throughout this entire book. Even in these chapters, the bodies that Darrow does honor at the beginning, that's only 100,000 of 4 million who died. And Alexander, they lost Alexander and thought he was dead for so long because he went to try to save people who were at would have died otherwise because of the storms caused by Orion going past the level that she was supposed to with the storm gods. And yeah, Atlas bringing that up at this point, he says it, you excuse evils for evils. Which one of us is really worse? And it's like, yeah, but
you, Vlad.
Well, especially since what Atlas did to Orion is what led her to do what she did.
Yeah, I just don't know why. I mean, I don't know. Look, if that guy had shown up and been a captive, I'd have been like, all right, somebody assemble a court martial. We're getting this done now. We're just gonna take right care of that.
I don't know what information they thought they could get out of him. You know, like, just bye.
Yeah. Let's just take this piece off the board. I don't know. Orion, like, getting the whole switch from the Matrix ending. Not like this. Not like this. Darrow couldn't have stationed somebody on the Storm God to be like, hey, look, you know, Orion's my friend, and she's been with me through this whole thing, kind of. But she's a little squirrely right now. So she said, starts to go overboard with the storm gods, you just hit her on the back of the head, just a little love tap right there on the back of the head, get her out.
To me, it sounds like once she was hooked up to it, there might have been basically no other way to disconnect her if she herself refused to disconnect. But either way, I feel the worst for Orion because of everything she had to endure and then having that ending period. And then Callaway, I feel bad for Callaway, who I've seen some things in the fandom where people are like, was maybe he in love with her? And I'm like, no, she was his teacher. But everybody loved Orion in that she was a hero of a color that had just been subservient, not to the point of red or even obsidians, who didn't know how society really was and what was really going on. You know, because the obsidians have their gods and they're taught that golds are gods, et cetera, et cetera. And reds are literally lied to their entire lives up until the rising happened. But the blues knew, but they were still a subservient class. And she rises above that and does so much good only to end up tortured to the point where she can't get beyond it. I don't know. It's like part of me is almost glad that so many people blame Darrow for what she did versus blaming her, because he also did know that she wasn't all there.
Yeah, but I mean, I talked about that before. One of Darrow's big tragic flaws is that he continues to believe the best of people. It's really weird to think that this guy who is leading the Rising also has some things in common, you know, with like Anne Frank. He still just believes that people are good at heart or whatever. Trustworthy, I guess, would be a better way to put it.
Shit, that trust, like, raises its ugly head again in these chapters. Even though he has some doubts and worries about Glorastes, he's still giving Glorastes all this power to create this thing for him, and then has these kind of doubts about Cato, and yet lets Cato go.
Like, would you... Let's see, and this guy's named Cato, you say, and he's with us? Okay, just checking. Why? No reason. One of the things that gets me about these books especially, and I think I talked about some examples again like earlier, it's just sort of like, well, there's a plot train a-coming, and everybody has to act in these ways so that the plot train reaches its station.
Just to interject a little bit, because I'm not sure all listeners would necessarily know the Cato reference you were trying to make.
Yeah.
The Cato I thought of and assumed, probably rightfully so, that this name was taken from was Cato the Younger. He was a conservative Roman senator, and he was basically focused on preserving Roman values. He thought that they were declining, so he wanted to preserve them, which is basically what Lysander's all about this entire book. So yes, the choice of the false name, granted, this is a name that he had used when he was way younger. And I'm not sure that there was any sort of reasoning behind that at that point. At this point, it's very telling of what he's trying to do.
And Cato, I will say this, I haven't read the history. What I did read was this rather sprawling epic called the Masters of Rome series, which is worth a read if you get a chance to do it and you've got time to read, oh gosh, I don't know, 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 pages, however many pages she wrote. But in it, the way his character is presented in that book is I would describe as possibly on the spectrum, because he is traditional Roman values to the point where it's like, these traditional Roman values, you're causing your problem. No, the only thing I need to do is traditional value harder. It's like, but if you do that, okay. And he annoys everybody, even his allies, and nobody really likes him.
So there's some similarities there as well.
Yeah. Oh, Lysander. Like, every time he reaches a conclusion and he's just like, okay, well, if it weren't for all the brutality and the infighting and the decadence and this and that, then Gold Society would work just fine.
But hey, Lysander's our next episode. So for now, there's so much to say about Lysander. But for now,
none of it good.
Darrow letting him go, though. Because just going back to the whole Darrow putting trust in people that he shouldn't have. And yes, I understand that he has some misgivings about Glorastes, or possible misgivings about Glorastes and about this Cato person. But like, as Nick said, oh my God, dude, maybe you follow through with your musings about how this pixie survived when all these other people didn't during the, you know, escape, the flight, whatever. These Darrow chapters, it's all dark, right? But they start off, okay, fine, whatever. Things are bad. But we get this moment of levity. And then in the end, it's just the frustration of, what are you doing with this EMP? I'm sorry, not sorry, but stop with the EMPs. They all know the fucking EMP trick by now, for Christ's sake. And also, I think there's like bits and pieces in this story about how a lot of armor and stuff is immune to EMP blasts. And I know that they're not trying to down armor or whatever. They're just trying to find a way off the planet. But it just, and also this is a desperate plan to get as many people as he can off of Mercury, because he knows it's fucked at this point. But still, I'm very angry with Darrow at the end of these chapters. Maybe not angry is the right word. Disappointed, I'll say.
Yeah. Well, I want to say it's almost a year ago now, I think, that I read the books. But I mean, I can go back and look at all the messages I sent you. I bothered Tara mercilessly. I was just like, ah, this!
It's never a bother. When somebody's talking to me about one of my favorite book series, it's never a bother.
But yeah, it's just so bad. Everything is so bad. I assume the next book is going to be better, if only for the title, but I guess we'll find out in about a month.
Month and a half.
Woo! Month and a half.
Well, normally this would be the point in the show where we do an in memoriam section. But yes, while we hear about people, including named characters, dying in this section, we're going to cover the actual deaths in our next episode, because that is when we hear quite a bit more about them. Because our next episode is covering Lysander's POV chapters from parts 2 and 3 of Dark Age.
Lysander's POS chapters.
That's actually not a bad idea. Hold on, let me make an edit to the next portion of the doc real quick. So as we close out this episode, just want to give a shout out to our heroes, to your patron, Tommy of the TKOK Podcast Network. Thanks so much for supporting us. Once again, I'm Tara, along with fellow host Nick, and regular guest host Seth. Hey. Don't forget, you can always hit us up at Sogs and Sass on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter, or email us at sogsandsass@gmail.com with any comments or thoughts you might have. As I already mentioned, our next episode is going to cover Lysander's, in Seth's words, POS chapters from parts 2 and 3 of Dark Age. Don't forget, please consider supporting us at patreon.com/geeksaga_entertainment for early access to our recordings.
Thank you for listening to the Sagas and Sass podcast. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter at Sagas and Sass.